resources. And today we are going to hear from, we're going to hear the House Bill 3204. And I guess, John, do you want to give a little introduction?
Sure.
And then Representative Lewis, are you going to? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are going to be working on House Bill 3204 this afternoon. 3204, you have a copy of the original House Bill 3204. You also have a copy of the Dash 4 amendment, which essentially replaces the original bill. And I think you also have a copy of Eleanor Hall's testimony. Eleanor is the administrator of the Health Division of the Department of Human Resources. This all involves smoking cessation programs and the funding of these programs. The Dash 4 amendment changes rather significantly the original bill, and I'm going to be focusing my remarks on the Dash 4 amendment. First of all, it allows the Health Division to, or it directs the Health Division to develop a smoking cessation reimbursement program. It allows the Health Division to adopt rules that govern the parameters of the program. And it requires the Health Division to report to the Emergency Board about the program prior to receiving funding from the Master Settlement Agreement, the Tobacco Agreement of 1998. I know that we have several people to testify, including Representative Lewis and Ms. Hall of the Health Division. So with that, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay. Thank you, John. Representative Lewis?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, committee, for the record, I'm Leslie Lewis, State Representative from District 29, and I'm here today to bring you House Bill 3204. This is a bill that actually started with an idea from a couple of constituents of mine, and you'll hear from one of them later, who are smokers. And they said to me, you know, the state's going to get a lot of money from the tobacco settlement plan from tobacco users, and they said it's too bad the state doesn't put some of that money into helping smokers actually quit smoking, cessation. And that was kind of the genesis of House Bill 3204. As you can see, it started out in a different form, and some of the things we got a little hung up on, how to do exactly the reimbursement, what kind of copay was necessary, and rather than get bogged down in that all of that minutia and try to put that in statute, we have worked with the Health Division, and I feel very good that the Health Division will work on making a workable smoking cessation program, and Ms. Hall will be testifying about that later in terms of designing a pilot program which will then help them write the rules to implement House Bill 3204. And what we believe will happen is that from the tobacco money that comes from the Master Settlement Agreement, that we could get a small amount of money this biennium, which we would intend to put in the Health Division's portion of the DHR budget, about $280,000. That would actually represent the interest off of the Health Security Fund, but you will see on line 14 of the Dash 4 amendments, we don't specify the Health Security Fund in case the Health Security Fund gets vetoed. But we would intend to get the money from that Master Settlement Agreement. And this would begin a pilot project for tobacco cessation. The Health Division is going to look at a number of things when it adopts rules, what kinds of providers that they will want to use for this program. They will want to look at, because there is a limited number of dollars, perhaps which individuals would be eligible for the program initially. And my hope would be that if the Health Security Fund is not vetoed, that we would continue to get more and more interest off of that fund. 10% of the fund is dedicated to tobacco prevention programs, including cessation. And my hope would be that one day we could really help a lot of Oregonians quit smoking through House Bill 3204. So we'd be taking a small step this session, but it would be my hope that in the future we could really help a lot of people quit smoking. And that's why House Bill 3204 is here.
Thank you. And are there questions? Representative Lewis? If not, we certainly thank you, Representative. We'd invite you back up here.
All right.
I think I'll go ahead and call some of the public testimony, and then we'll hear from the Health Division. So, okay. Tom Holt. And I call another. Larry Bonson wants to come up as well.
Chair Tutova, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. We represent the profession, the individual pharmacists, of which there are about 2,500 practicing in the state. We've been involved in this bill from early on, working with the proponents, and while it's not everything that we would dream of seeing in a smoking cessation program, I think it's a very positive start. And we would hope that as the Health Division engages in the rulemaking for the pilot project, that they are inclusive of all the healthcare providers who are involved in providing counseling services as well as the pharmaceuticals necessary for some people to be successful in smoking cessation, including our members. And that's really all I had to say about it. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Okay.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Larry Bonsack. I'm here to represent the gazillions of smokers who are out there. It is, as a smoker, it is concerning that we are hearing a lot of messages on how important it is to quit smoking, and that we should quit smoking, and I believe the statistics are 70% or 75% of smokers want to quit, but there aren't a lot of effective resources available in helping those people quit. The incidence of smoking addiction is higher among lower income people. The cost of smoking cessation programs for them is probably not as high as smoking is, but it's still to come up with that money at one time is out of reach. It is my hope that you will pass this legislation that will encourage people to quit smoking and also encourage people to come up and develop more effective smoking cessation programs. Thank you.
Question?
Just now you said 75% of smokers say they want to quit.
That is according to the statistics I've read from the Oregon Health Department.
Thank you.
And I am in the process of quitting. It isn't fun.
Thank you very much. Larry Harvey?
Good afternoon, Chairman Qtub, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larry Harvey. I'm here today on behalf of the American Cancer Society. I don't think there are a lot of remarks that need to be offered here. We've been involved in working our way through this bill and how it could be best implemented and funded for quite some time. And I appreciate very much the role that Representative Lewis has played and how cooperative she and other folks in the health community have helped out. So the American Cancer Society has asked me to take a look at these, and I have had a couple of conversations with them. This seems to be the best process that we could certainly implement here. And for some people it's great, and other people it could be better, but I think in the final analysis, what we really need to do is, the devil is always in the details, and this provides you as legislative leaders still the opportunity to come back and take a look at the most effective way that a program could be implemented. And so we would be here supporting that process and hoping to be continue to be involved, I should say, in developing whatever that program might be in the future. Happy to answer any questions, although I'm sure I've been very vague.
What is the note we have here on testimony we're going to receive from Eleanor Hall is 7,000 Oregonians dying each year. How closely can you tie that to actual cigarette use?
Senator Q-Tub, Senator George, I think probably what I would say, my response to that would be to defer to Ms. Hall, because the epidemiologist has prepared quite a bit of information regarding the relationship, and I think it's a commonly known fact. I was intrigued at the different types of warning labels that they now have available. As we recall, the warning labels that the Surgeon General originally asked for was that smoking could cause other diseases. As I was at a convenience store the other day, I noticed that the new label says that quitting smoking will probably prolong your life. So I'm not sure if we're going forward or backwards in that respect with regard to where the tobacco companies have moved us. But the exact nature and causes, the cost, the fiscal impact to Oregonians as a result of tobacco use in Oregon is close to $1 billion a year. It's tremendous because of the health care costs. Dealing with that issue has consistently been the result of a comprehensive program. We do need cessation programs. We also need prevention programs. We also need education programs so that young people do not begin to take up a habit that will shorten their lives and continue to cost Oregonians money. So, not being a physician, I couldn't give you the medical language for the exact links, but you know they're there.
Thank you. Other questions? If not, thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Then I would call up Eleanor Hall.
Good afternoon, Chief and committee members. For the record, my name is Eleanor Hall, and I'm the administrator of the Oregon Health Division. And I'm here today to speak in support of expanding cessation treatment resources to help Oregonians quit using tobacco. House Bill 3204 provides funding to reimburse providers for smoking cessation programs for Oregonians who are otherwise not insured for this service. It gives the Health Division authority to establish administrative rules to guide the implementation of the program. And under the guidelines for establishing administrative rules, it calls for us to work with interested parties, and that would certainly be our interest here, is to bring together people who are interested in this to help us begin developing the rules. Funds for this program are to come from those monies received by the State of Oregon from tobacco products manufacturers under the Master Settlement Agreement of 1998, namely the Attorney General's suits that have been settled. We have worked with Co-Chair Leslie Lewis and her staff regarding this bill, and the language you have before you today is a result of those discussions. As you know, tobacco use is the leading cause of preventable death and disease among Oregonians. It is responsible for close to 7,000 deaths each year. And Oregon was one of the first states to have a section on the death certificate which says whether tobacco is an underlying cause or not of the illness. So we're able to come at this figure two ways. We have statistical algorithms that are nationally applied that say that 25% of heart disease is related to smoking and X percent of infant mortality. And then we're also able to look at our own death certificates and see how closely those are matching the national statistics in Oregon. So it is really a tremendous toll of shortened lives from infants that are born at low birth weight to older people whose lives are shortened. We have used national logarithms again to calculate the cost and find that tobacco is costing Oregonians $1.5 billion a year in medical expenses and lost productivity. That is, from people who die prematurely and whose contributions to their families and society is cut short. About 500,000 adults and 60,000 of our children here in Oregon use tobacco. In fact, the equivalent of a classroom of children each day begin using tobacco in our state. The Tobacco Education and Prevention Program, funded by Ballot Measure 44 revenues, is dedicated to reducing the use of tobacco and reducing the health and economic burden of tobacco. This program, which you heard about as part of budget hearings, is managed by the Health Division and has three primary goals. We want to help young people avoid tobacco use. Never start. If they can get to age 20 without starting, the chances are very reduced that they will ever begin smoking. We want to protect Oregonians from the dangers of secondhand smoke, and we also want to assist Oregonians who use tobacco to quit and to stay quit. It's an important goal. Although we're very concerned about youth, 85% of total smokers in Oregon are not youth. They're people who are beyond their teens, and if we really are going to see quick turnarounds in the toll of tobacco, we need to help adults stop smoking. So our current program has several activities that support tobacco cessation. We have the Oregon Quit Line. This is a telephone-based cessation support program that is serving an average of 800 Oregonians each month. That's almost 10,000 a year. And this is a program that's also being used by a number of the private health care managed care plans. It's run by Group Health Puget Sound, and has really a great record in counseling people about how to stop. And one of the nice things about the Quit Line is it's available to people regardless of where they live, so that rural people can take advantage of it in the same way that people who maybe are around more active support groups can take advantage of it. So it's very convenient, and it is being accessed by a lot of people. We also are funding a number of cessation demonstration projects. Some are working with adolescents, some are working with adults, some are working with pregnant women. We're spending about $1.2 million on those cessation programs, typically in our demonstration grants, where we'll be evaluating them closely to see which of those cessation interventions are the most effective. We've also been very involved with the Oregon Medical Plan, the OMAP, Oregon Health Plan, around helping do what's called Project Prevention, which brings together the medical directors of all the plans which accept Oregon Health Plan clients and sets some goals around how those patients will get advice to quit and assistance with quitting and how they will track the outcomes of that process. And we got a special, we're providing some staff to OMAP to help implement that. We also received a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to track that and find out how that's working, which providers are able to make the most impact on their patients and what kind of supports could they use. We are also supporting the general coalition activities, which include emphasis on tobacco-free workplaces and tobacco-free public places. And research shows that more than any other intervention, a tobacco-free workplace will help promote quitting and staying quit. So when someone's office goes smoke-free, 65% of the people then make an active decision to go ahead and quit, and it's one of the biggest incentives to help people to stop smoking. We also believe that our media campaign is providing motivating and informational messages that will help tip people from being in that 75% who want to quit to being in the 20% who actually try to quit. So we think that cessation is a really important part of the whole tobacco education and prevention program. We do, however, think these efforts can be enhanced to provide even more support to people who are ready to quit. We are planning to conduct a pilot project in this next year that will test the effectiveness of expanding cessation support services. We anticipate paying for additional smoking cessation support, such as nicotine replacement therapy. We know for some people that can really make a difference to have that pharmacological support, either actual pills or the nicotine replacement. We do want to use the existing Quit Line to screen smokers for readiness to quit. Sometimes people know it's not the right time to quit, but they just want more information. They're building up to it. They're thinking about it. We anticipate using vouchers and or contracts in order to provide upfront funding for cessation. We think if there is a financial barrier to participating in cessation programs, it will help people more to give them a paid-for slot or to give them a voucher than to reimburse them after the fact when they would have had to come up with the money up front. We expect to spend approximately $100,000 of our existing tobacco program allocation from within the innovation and demonstration projects to get this demonstration cessation project off the ground right away. And I believe there will be a budget note potentially in our budget to that effect, and we are certainly willing to see that happen. We plan to use the information from the Health Division's demonstration project to help design the program called for in 3204. We would have some months of experience as we go to write the rules, and when we come back to the e-board, as is called for in 3204, we could tell you how this has been working, to work with the quit line, to work with pharmacological support, and so on. The Health Division is planning to use our existing tobacco resources for the administrative costs related to 3204, presuming that we can keep these costs at a reasonable level. And so designing a simple program that is probably more focused than otherwise will be important in keeping the administrative costs at a reasonable level, because we do anticipate that the total expenditure on this program under 3204 in this next biennium would be about $280,000. So that will certainly not meet all of the need, and we would like to have a fairly focused program. We do also plan to continue our efforts with the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon and OMAP to train healthcare providers in implementing effective cessation programs. We would like to do more work with dentists, pharmacists, and other healthcare practitioners around working with their patients. That's a very effective thing. When the provider tells the patient, you must stop smoking, and we're going to help you do it. So we're excited to be part of this process, and while this bill is not part of the governor's budget, we do believe it would enhance the current tobacco prevention and education program, and that if new funds are available from the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, the Health Division believes that this would be a very wise investment. I'd be glad to answer questions.
One thing I want to mention to the committee members, that if you look at the date on the amendment, 6/24/99, this is a recent rendition of this, and you may have letters in your file that are opposed to this bill, but that was prior to the working out of the agreement of this particular bill. So don't be confused by some of the messages you might find in your file, because as I look through mine, there are letters against it, and it was primarily, I think, for the use of different funds. So, with that, are there questions?
Really quickly, no, sir. So we're pretty sure about that 7,000 number, 7,000 deaths per year.
Yes, sir.
So what I'm trying to get in my place in my perspective here is all the grief. We took over 3 deaths relative to the non-use of motorcycle helmets. This is 2,300% for dead weight. And I just wonder if the media will tag it with such a importance as what we're seeing here.
Chair Kutub and Senator George, our tobacco reports, I think, present some shocking statistics saying that tobacco is killing more people than AIDS, suicide, homicide, and motor vehicle accidents put together. It's really a huge toll.
And I would just say, Senator George, too, I have come to the realization prior to this, because, you hear it's a legal product,
mm-hmm.
all this other stuff, in looking at some of the reports about how really it does affect health and is a direct cause for a lot of things. And, there are a lot of respected people that have written on it, Dr. Koop being one, who's been very outspoken about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I've just come around to realizing it is killer, and it causes a lot of diseases or exacerbates, diseases. So.
Can I do a quick one?
Okay.
Okay, thank you. One of the issues that's been raised, and I find it very intriguing, that when you take the whole equation of the person that's smoking, that actually we save money on them because they die earlier. And when you take the whole life, its normal life expectancy, is that true?
Dr. Kevin, Senator George, I think we talked about that a little bit during budget hearings. And one of the issues is people often have many extensive problems as they're dying, having their life shortened from tobacco. And I'll try to get back to you with the explicit. There are some issues around that. I think those are purely monetary equations, though, and aren't looking at what it means to families and communities and
mm-hmm.
loved ones to lose someone, which is probably never accounted for in these numbers.
Thanks, Christine. Thank you.
Senator Steele.
Yeah, you
talked a lot in terms of the algorithms and so on that you use for projection. You've got some statistics now on youth who do not begin to smoke. And you say if you get them to 20 and they don't start smoking, it's likely they never will. Does the present number of youth that are starting to smoke indicate 10 years from now a downturn in the number, or is it an increase in the number? What's that look like?
Well, Chair Chutub and committee members, it's actually very sobering. At this point, we have 30% of young people under age 18 using tobacco regularly, and only about 22% of people over 18 using tobacco regularly. So unless those young people quit at a really unprecedented rate, we are looking at some real problems as they mature. And those are the people who, of course, will be having the next generation of babies and being our next workforce, and it could be some real problems. It's interesting that when you quit those youngsters, a huge percent of them expect to quit within 2 years. But 5 years later, most of them are still smoking.
So a follow-up to that, don't these incredibly good ads and so on seem to have any impact on these kids?
Well, Chair Kutub and committee members, this is the question of our age, is how can we affect youth risk behaviors and have young people make good choices and healthy choices. And we do think the comprehensive strategy that addresses adults and young people will have an effect on young people, and that we are beginning to see that now in Oregon. But we do think it does take a little more time to affect youth behavior, and that it's important that the whole society have changes, that young people emulate their parents and other adults and role models in their community. So I think a program that's strictly focused on youth will not work, but I think the program we do have will work on youth.
I was going to ask a question. You indicated that when they are asked when they'll stop, and they think they'll be able to stop in 2 years. What do they, first of all, have you asked them why they started? And if you have, do we know why?
Chair Kutub, it appears that kids start smoking in part because they don't internalize the warnings. They think that maybe it's dangerous, but that's a long way off, and they'll be able to stop before then, this kind of immortality belief that kids have. I think that advertising does position it as a rite of passage and as a way to be a cool adult, potentially to be a little bit of a rebel, and that they're getting cues from the advertising. And it's certainly heavily promoted in venues where kids are, whether it's Rolling Stone magazine or these tobacco clubs where kids can go and smoke. It's very promoted.
I hate to say this, but I've actually seen some statistics that show since kids have gotten more education about smoking, the rate of
smoking has gone up.
Smoking has gone up. So
that's true.
Even telling kids they shouldn't be smoking is making them think, ah, if this is a forbidden fruit, let me try it so I can rebel.
Well,
and, so I do like the emphasis on some of what you're doing here is kind of moving away from that. As much as we want to affect that, sometimes what we do is affect it, but we affect it in the reverse because we spend so much time talking to them about it, and they just simply are at an age where they want to test the boundaries, and that's more than to do it. I have another question, and then I'll let the committee ask some. It has to do with what was originally in the bill, and it talked about successful completion, and this from your testimony, it indicates that what you're going to do is screen them ahead of time. I'm wondering a couple things about that. How, from that screening, are you going to determine somebody who will successfully complete the program? One question. Will they have more than one bite at the apple as far as a voucher from the state to have another chance? And is there any other way of is there any way of actually checking the success of this and doing it the reverse, where we reimburse after they have successfully complete.
Thank you, Tom and committee members. Those are all some very interesting questions. It's true this bill does move away from the idea of reimbursing someone who has successfully completed and moves toward helping people take steps to quit up front. We were concerned that it would be quite difficult to know whether someone has successfully completed or not. You can do, in essence, drug tests to see if there's nicotine in their body, but that's expensive in and of itself and potentially demeaning for people. We were also concerned the facts are that people often try 3, 4, 5, 6 times before they're able to quit. That's more the norm than the exception. And we didn't want to set something up where not only did they fail to quit, but they failed to qualify for reimbursement and they're a double failure. And they go away feeling like, I'll never try again. This has been such a disappointing experience and I am such a louse. We really want to give people a lot of support and say, it's not your fault. If you didn't quit this time, that happens a lot. Now you're ready to really quit. You know where your downfalls are. You know you can't just smoke one. So we will be looking for people who really are ready to quit. If there's some readiness criteria where they move from thinking about it to having a plan, to setting a date, to being ready to set a date, to getting support, to talking about how they're going to cope with difficult cues and settings. So we would be asking them those kind of questions, but not necessarily trying to say, you probably won't succeed, so we won't help you, but you will succeed. So we'd look for people who are really ready. And I think that the questions about how we should allocate this relatively small pot of money are things we should work out in the rules. You know, should we? And I don't know the answer. I think we'd want to have some look at what are really good practices and what would be the best way to do this.
Madam Chair.
I was intrigued by the fact that you're also following up with good, you know, the what works with on that project prevention. Senator George.
I was concerned about that direction change, too, and I'll tell you why. Because when they call me in for a drug test for my CDL license, they could care less how I feel about it. They give you the jar and they tell you what to do, and they charge you $100. Now, here I'm going in on a program that I volunteered to do. I demonstrated I'm successful, and they're going to give me $600. That's a little bit of a different scenario. So I wish we were taking more of that approach, and I hope that's considered, because, and you know, we don't worry too much about folks' self-esteem on a lot of areas, and so I think here is a case where the person's getting something out of this. In other words, number one, I completed my program and I'm successful now stopping smoking. And number two, I'm going to get some of this money back. I mean, it might be a better incentive program.
John, did you have a comment about
that? Yeah, just to clarify, Madam Chair and Senator George, you know that the Dash 4 does not pay these folks $600.
Right. That's right. That's what I'm saying, though. I'm saying. Okay. I was comparing this with, I know this is basically unlimited, right? If we decide it's unlimited.
Madam Chair, if I might respond to that, we will have a limited amount of money this biennium coming to us from the Health Security Fund. The Health Division has graciously offered to send $100,000 of their existing money on a pilot program, which will help us write the rules. And then there should be, from the interest on the Health Security Fund, $280,000. That's, you know, I think they're going to learn a lot from the pilot program, and I think they're, you know, going to end up, you know, having to be cognizant of the fact that with limited dollars, they really do need to reach those people who are the most ready to quit and try to get them into a successful program that will help them quit. But I think you do have to realize that smokers do have to try more than once, just as many of us with some of our other bad habits, eating too much or whatever. Oftentimes we have to try more than once. And you know, my goal is to help Oregonians quit smoking, and that's why we went this approach of letting them write the rules, because we didn't want to throw up unnecessary roadblocks. And we want them to use their expertise and help us design the best, most effective program we can have.
Eleanor, if you answer the question about going through it more than once, are being...
It does say the rules will establish a maximum reimbursement limit for each participant, and I would anticipate that we would specify something about how many times we would let people go through it.
Okay.
I do anticipate that an average... Some of the programs that are run by the Heart and Cancer Associations only cost $25.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a token payment so that people are serious about doing it. So we do think we should make money go a long way, and in that kind of situation, it's probably good to give someone a voucher or to give someone support up front and try to get them in the program. And that's where we would be looking at this, rather than you pay and then you send us a bill and prove that it really worked.
Kind of establish an amount, and within that amount, if somebody went to the lung or cancer society and they were able to be part of a program for $25 versus a $600 program, there would be X amount for that person, and they could go to that. Is that what you're saying?
We also know an important thing that people want is access to these patches or pharmaceuticals. So one possibility is we would have some amount set aside for buying pharmaceuticals for people who otherwise have other supports. They say, I can go to the group at work, but boy, I would like you to buy my patch. So I think there will probably be sort of column A, column B, column C, and...
I'm trying to understand this bill. There's a whole new approach to this. It's really interesting. Are we saying that, okay, a cessation program, first of all, I guess I'd like to know what we're saying by that. We're trying to get people to stop smoking entirely, right?
Right.
And then we're going to reimburse providers. Program providers. What programs? I mean, people who are setting up designing programs for cessation. Is that what we mean by that?
We're not going to pay them for setting them up, but they would, the health division, and maybe Eleanor.
We're reimbursing. Yeah. Okay, Eleanor.
Because I know you've had more conversations.
Yeah.
So if you want to answer that about cessation providers.
Well, we do think that people who call our quit line and show that they're ready to quit, we would dialogue with them about what would help you quit.
Okay.
Have you tried groups? Are you interested in a group? Do you need pharmacological support? What's your insurance like? What's your ability to pay for this like?
Mm-hmm.
How can we help you have a successful quit experience?
Okay.
Now, I think we would have rules that would be more detailed about the amount we would pay and how we would allocate these monies, and I think we should talk with people about what would really help people. A lot of people actually don't want to go to groups. They don't have the time, or they live remote from groups. But they might benefit from having a pharmacy, access to pharmaceuticals, and how should we best do that?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we would reimburse people who help stop someone from smoking. And my guess is that we would create some kind of a... voucher, which we would send to the person that says, you can submit this, your provider can submit this to the health division and receive it, or to the health division's quit line contractor and receive a check for reimbursement of Nicorette gum or patches or participation in this kind of a group.
Mm-hmm. Eleanor, could you tell us a little bit more about who a provider might be? Now the health division will determine that somebody is a valid provider, and are you also going to write rules about that? Or
I think we need to.
I think that was really nice.
Yes, originally I think there was a vision that anybody could be a provider and that we would reimburse anyone, and I do think that under this bill we would use the rules to try to have a more focused approach on who we would reimburse. And I do imagine that we might potentially have some contracts in the metro areas so that there would be slots. We might say, you know, the Cancer Society will be willing to take at least 20 people coming through the quit line every month, and then we would tell people you could go to this as a prepaid patient. In the rural areas, I don't think that would be quite as work as well because there's not the volume of people. But, yes, we would have a limited focus on providers in order to keep the administrative costs.
Mm-hmm. We'll control them.
Yeah.
and I know there's some wish that we do more experimental and innovative things, and I think that's possible too, but probably not on a broad scale right at first.
Follow up, Representative Wilson. All right, so then you have individuals who are going to call your quit line, and they're not a provider. They're trying to break the habit. And so are you going to then refer them to a provider? Are you going to deal with them individually as someone that would receive funding for a reimbursement for their costs?
Currently, we give them quite a bit of counseling on the telephone now, and if they have insurance that covers smoking cessation, we have a big directory that tells them what their insurance would cover, and we help them get hooked up to those programs. People who don't have insurance get up to 7 counseling sessions on the phone with us, and anybody, we mail information to their homes about how to quit and so on. And, but people who don't have insurance, we do quite a lot of therapy for them now on our telephone line. So my sense is we would work with them on the line about what it is they need and what they want to do, and we would reach an agreement with them about what they were going to do, not just have them go off and then send us a bill.
Yeah, okay.
So we would enter into an agreement that last time this didn't work, this time you think it would work, here's how we're going to pay for it. And I would hope that a lot of people would feel they could pay for it themselves and that we would be engaging in sort of a joint planning. If they stop smoking a pack a day, they can save quite a lot of money toward their own care.
Okay. One additional question. A lot of the letters I have come from this tobacco prevention education program advocates, and how does this program differ then from that one?
You know, I think that this program focuses on using some new dollars from the Attorney General settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a more defined pot of money. So rather than being an open-ended entitlement that anybody could get, regardless of how much it costs, we would try to run this to meet the budget that the legislature allocates.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are really important differences. And it's also, I think the rules are going to allow us to have a be very selective about which providers we pay rather than having their potentially be a completely market-driven model where smokers hook up with potentially very expensive and or ineffective strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we would try to bring research and best practices into the process of deciding which things to reimburse and how many times to reimburse and how to decide who to reimburse for. So it's really quite a different program, and I think where it's similar is that we're trying to reduce financial barriers to cessation
mm-hmm.
using money that, in effect, tobacco users have put into the settlement.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, how would you do the evaluation aspect of it to find out, you know, whether this is a good way to spend our money or not?
Mm-hmm. I think we would want to work through this a little bit more with people who are writing the rules and with my program staff, because you can evaluate is it very effective to buy pharmacological support, or is it more effective to give people more access to group support? That's fairly easy for us to do, but in terms of saying is it more effective to support cessation or is it more effective to support prevention, that is more beyond the scope of this particular project, and that's something we look to national and even international work to try to decide how to allocate the Measure $44. So we do think we've got a very effective model of allocating those dollars, and we were very concerned that those dollars not be pulled away from what we think is a very effective plan now that's led to over 35,000 fewer Oregonians smoking since we started. But I would not see that's getting at your question.
Well, actually, the piece of this that I'm interested in having us assess is whether we can, in fact, take people who call us on the phone and economically support that person in getting to a plan and then providing some subsidy for that plan. And that's the piece that I'm interested in, because I think this has a lot of promise. It's a very exciting idea. The people who are out there in the tutors and are frustrated, and maybe they've been to their doctor and it didn't work, or maybe they've you know, been talking to their husband, and that didn't work, and that you have an expert on the phone who, in a fairly economical way, is giving guidance and reaching an agreement, and the money is the contract that helps that person to move forward on a plan. And I think this is an exciting possibility. And so what I'm saying is, how can we evaluate, how can we do an evaluation to figure out if this is a good way, or just the other ways we have of having these categorized programs and education is a better way. And that was the piece that I was trying to say, if there was any plan to evaluate that.
Well, Chair, Chief and Representative Ross, you know, we are evaluating our FIT line now. And I'm sorry I don't have more details about the evaluation process, but we are committed to evaluating every component of the program, including the FIT line. And I can let your committee know right now how we're evaluating the FIT line and how we would, we would have to talk about how we would evaluate the effect of having this flexible money and what difference does that make. That we're seeing building on an existing program that is being evaluated.
That would be something I would hope that we would work toward, because it is exciting, and but this would be exciting. You have to sign the table, doesn't prove it.
I think I have some of the questions, and then I'll refer to Representative Luce. So some of the questions I have just heard tell me that you're not understanding what this is.
Well, in Section 2 of the amendment, it does direct the division to report to the governor and to those committees of the legislative assembly to which matters of public health are assigned regarding the implementation of the program as part of its biennial tobacco prevention program report. So we are going to be asking the health division biennially to report on the effectiveness of this program along with all of their other programs. And I think it will be something that the next legislature can, you know, have some data, hopefully, from the health division about how well this essentially pilot program worked.
Right. Thank you. Senator
Giard? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. What right now, how much are we spending on the Oregon Quick line with all of the materials that they mail out and all the other costs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I believe it's about $1.2 million a year.
Okay. And then the next question, you noted on the second page of your testimony that several cessation demonstration projects are underway. Any of them similar to this concept of approaching, particularly the original concept of the bill?
Senator George, they are much more focused on special populations. So, for instance, we have some programs that are working in schools that have groups of adolescents who are trying to stop smoking, a boys group and a girls group, and they meet every few days in school. We have another project that's working with pregnant women in the WIC program. So they are rather different in concept from this.
Okay.
Where they take people who are in a setting and provide a program right there on site for them. This would be for the general population to a greater extent.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
I promised you I wasn't going to make things longer, so I don't want to ask you any questions.
Go ahead.
But I just have questions in my head bouncing around. If you allow them to come out, I'll
go for it.
Does that mean you just overruled yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
did. Well, you know, I keep getting kind of hung up on this question that I asked earlier today, which has to do with, you know, youth beginning and whether the projection is a downturn. You kind of indicated it could indicate an upturn because the kids consider themselves invulnerable or something. And I'm just wondering if you or anybody in the country is really trying to retune the message to try to offset this invulnerability kind of justifying logic of kids. I mean, what this really does bother me. I'm very serious about it.
And
it's hard to articulate, and that's why I kind of was teasing the chair for a minute, but this is real disturbing to me.
Well, Chair Cutelba and committee members, it certainly is very disturbing. And it's true that this increase in youth smoking has occurred at a time when we've become more conscious of the dangers of tobacco. Some of it may indeed be a backlash of kids saying, watch me rebel. But also, it's occurred at a time when tobacco has been more heavily marketed to youth. And the brands that have been most heavily marketed and marketed in the ways that are most appealing to young people are the brands that young people are smoking. So we think some of this is the pushback of the tobacco industry, not just the fact that our program for some are leading kids to smoke. There's some very encouraging things that are coming out of tobacco cessation programs, including the data in Florida, which showed 20% drops in youth smoking based on a very aggressive media and advertising program, which was partly designed by children. We're seeing drops in smoking in our own school programs, and our school programs will have pre-test, pre-numbers, and post-numbers. And we're getting that data in now as part of the youth behavior risk survey that's being done this spring in schools. And we will be able to tell you whether we're seeing a drop in our school programs. But we're certainly committed to those areas, too. And it is important to do the right thing because we could waste a lot of money and have a lot of kids' lives in danger if we weren't doing the right thing.
Senator Shields? Is that it?
Well, I mean, you know, I just have these serious questions, and it really worries me.
I understand it worries me, too. But we're not talking about the entire thing.
Yeah.
Right now, we're talking about 3204 in this decision.
Yeah, and this might actually, this will definitely be my final question if I can ask it, and that would be, is there any positive results from the settlements thrust that tobacco companies are not allowed to so aggressively market to kids anymore? I mean, have we been able to determine any positives out of that?
Chair Q-Tub and committee members, I think it's too early to say. The public health community remains concerned that this is a very smart industry, and that if they can't market with billboards, why the internet is actually really the best place to go. So there's always this kind of, we think it's important to change the community's norms and values and change to demand, not just reduce advertising messages. So I'm not banking on those advertising messages to make a huge difference. I mean, I'm not banking on the settlement itself to make a huge difference. It was a good start, but I don't think it's the answer.
So if the tobacco money is vetoed in any event that President Clinton vetoes it, then this program will only have $100,000 to set up rules, no money for implementation.
Madam Chair, I mentioned the veto of the Health Security Fund by the governor. But if he vetoes the Health Security Fund, we'll still have the tobacco money, but we won't be limited to use of the interest on it, but which is the current limit in House Bill 2007. We're limited to use of 10% of the interest, which in this biennium will only be $280,000. But because we don't know for sure whether we haven't specifically described the Health Security Fund in this bill, because we would still like to get money from the Master Settlement Agreement for Health Bill 3204. However, we are going to go ahead in the Health Division's budget and limit it to $280,000, assuming that 2007 passes.
Well, thank you. I misunderstood. I thought maybe the litigation fund would be vetoed by President Clinton. But this is by Governor Kitzhaber on 2007.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Chair Kitzhaber, Senator, perhaps I could clarify. $100,000 would actually be used to run a reimbursed smoking cessation program. We wouldn't use it just to write rules. Like the data and information and pilot, we do have a pilot. It would help us inform us on how to write good rules.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be services for smokers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's much better.
Yeah. No, we don't much.
We're all writing rules.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
If I could, just to clarify a couple of things. The $280,000 that is in House Bill 2007 would not be available until midway through the upcoming biennium. That's one thing. And the other piece is that under Section 2, the Health Division has to report to the Emergency Board and says here, and shall request the necessary expenditure limitation. So it wouldn't, the $280,000, as I read this, would not be in the budget bill for the Health Division. They would have to come back and request from the E-Board. And that also allows the E-Board to look over the program, get a report on the proposed program before they release the money, or before they provide expenditure limitations to the Health Division.
Thank you for that clarification. So there are no more questions for Delmar Hall. So excuse you. I did get a note from Phyllis Rand. Phyllis, if you'd like to give us some brief.
Unless you have the key gear,
right.
Yeah, it's too warm in here. Senator Kutub, members of the committee, I'm Phyllis Rand from Salem, Oregon. And I just wanted to share with you, and especially Senator George, because he made a comment that triggered my need to tell you what happened.
The reputation of doing that.
Right, yes, you do. And my ex-husband, Dewey Ram, Jr., died December the 16th from cancer of the lung. And he was only 72. But there were many medical things that happened to him, such as a growth the size of a grapefruit on his kidneys, and many surgeries on the lungs. And during one of those surgeries, he had a heart attack, and then it was necessary to do quadruple bypass. So it doesn't matter how old you are. And he started smoking when he was just in high school, and it was the thing to do. And over 20 years ago, he quit, but that still didn't make any difference. He still had cancer of the lungs. So I just wanted to share that information with you, because once you have cancer, it develops and complications arise. And when he died, he was just skin and bones. He looked like an old man. It was very heart-wrenching. And so I just wanted to share that with you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I lost two uncles, one almost identical set of circumstances, and it was horrible to watch the consequences, and it was almost identical to this in the sense of all of the surgeries and the heart attack, and particularly with one of them, and it is a terrible way to pass.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3204.
And
Representative Lewis.
I would move the -4 amendments to House Bill 3204.
Representative Lewis has moved the -4 amendment to House Bill 3204. Is there discussion? Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, the amendment has been passed.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lewis.
I would move House Bill 3204 as amended to the full committee for Ways and Means.
Representative Lewis has moved House Bill 3204 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, that's his pass. Representative Lewis, would you
carry it to the floor?
And on the floor, House floor.
I believe that is going to be approved, my
all right. Oh, all right.
The Manifest Human Resource okay. Committee originally.
And, let's see. I guess I can carry it. No, that's cool. I can carry it on the Senate floor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Thank you all very much for withstanding this heat. And we're going to adjourn.
Yeah.
We will be back.